You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
This is Ken Vellante with the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. And for this episode, really excited to have Rachel Lally, who is in Dublin, Ireland. And she, I encountered her work with a podcast called Six of One, Half a Dozen of the Other. And it's a really, really fun podcast she does with other artists. In talking about thought experiments and philosophy, really super stuff. But she does a lot. She's definitely a creator, does works in theater, is a singer, actress, thinker, philosopher, activist. Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ken. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's thanks for spending the time. The first question we ask, we try to go back to the beginning, is what were you like as a young child, as young Rachel?
Young Rachel was probably very different to grown up Rachel. I was a chronically shy child, very, very quiet. I was a voracious reader. I ate books. I used to go to the library, get loads of books and have them read at the end of that day. It used to drive my parents crazy because they'd buy me books and I'd have them finished half an hour later. And it was so expensive. I was not a very athletic or outdoorsy kid. I was very much a very feminine child. When I was very young, I refused to wear trousers or anything. I would only wear dresses. I think I just totally lived in this fantasy world where I was a princess and I just daydreamed all day and was very imaginative, always loved dressing up and stories. But much shyer than I am now. I was the kind of child that would kind of sit quietly and take everything in and listen and watch.
Yeah, I find that, I asked that question and, over 40 episodes with the podcast, and I find it very interesting because most everybody I talk to, there's definitely an element where they kind of isolate themselves a little bit or kind of a little bit shy, or they create their own space to do their own thing. And it sounds like with some of the comments you mentioned, you just had a little more of a fantasy kind of imagination, as a young child. Would that be correct?
Yeah, absolutely. It's because I was so shy that somebody suggested to my mom that I should go and try a drama lesson to give me some confidence and make me more outgoing. And I think that backfired massively.
It backfired. So what was your experience when that happened? Was that tried then?
Oh, yeah. So my mom brought me to a speech and drama class, and I absolutely loved it. So I just got into theater and drama at a really young age, and I just was really hungry for it. Just wanted to do more and more. So I grew up in Dublin, but we moved as a family out to the countryside when I was about 11 or 12 years old, into a really remote part of the Irish countryside. And then there was no drama classes and there were no dance classes and stuff. And I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. So my parents ended up having to drive me miles to go to drama lessons and youth theatre and stuff when I was that little bit older. So, yeah, kind of backfired on them a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you needed your space to be able to develop. And what forms of art? Do you participate in? You're obviously interested in quite a few things, and I view you as a creator. I think sometimes creator is a little bit different and more useful of a word. But as that went along with the performance, what type of forms of art did you develop into as you got older?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I mean, for me, theatre is kind of where things started. From that, I mean, visual art, I took art in school, I loved it. And I studied theatre kind of all my life, right through secondary school or high school, I suppose, in the US. And when I finished school, then I went to college. I decided I had like kind of done some short films and stuff at that stage, had acted in them, and I wanted to know how everything behind the scenes worked. So I decided I was going to study media. So I did a little bit of radio journalism, TV and camera work. And I went on then to get a diploma in film studies. And then when I finished that, I left college and auditioned for a theatre company and toured around Italy for a year as an actor. And part of that was doing theatre in education in schools. So I got really into that. So that was where my teaching and facilitation comes in. So like passing skills on to other people. Like in recent years, then I've got into writing a lot more. I think it was something I was very afraid of for a while. So I've got into kind of writing poetry and spoken word and writing my own scripts and directing and doing different roles in the theatre. So yeah, kind of a little bit of everything. I also sang with a heavy metal band. I guess when you're in the theatre, you kind of end up sort of dancing and singing and doing stuff like that, or trying new things depending on what project you're involved in. So like I love physical theatre. So yeah, just kind of lots of stuff kind of sprawls.
Yeah, and I'm not going to let you get away with just, you know, mention heavy metal. So tell us about, I mean, I tend to get, I've had a few folks who play, who play in a metal band sing. A recent guest I had, Sarah Bilt, plays guitar, lead singer, kind of like a soul blues doom metal type of sound. When anybody's a metalhead that I'm talking to, I try to find out what was it like for you? I know you said it was a short amount of time that you performed in that band, but what was that? I view it as, let me just say, I mean, metal for me is a super intense, super important outlet, particularly live, when you know, that's available. So talk to us about metal and your experience, singing in that band.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been into metal for probably since I was about 14 or 15. I think I heard a Metallica album for the first time and was like, what is this? Like, this is amazing. And kind of went from there. Like I think a lot of my mother's friends were kind of into heavy metal, and they used to give me lots of tapes, and they're all CDs and stuff. And then in school, we kind of had a little like group of misfits, I suppose. We were all very like very good students in school, very intelligent. We like weren't much trouble, but I think the teachers kind of disliked that we were all going around with these heavy metal hoodies, and I think they were kind of very suspicious of us and on what we were up to. But it was a very inclusive group, and we all like, you know, tape traded and swapped CDs and stuff. And then I went to in Ireland, we have like a region in Ireland where Gaelic is spoken, still like a very much alive language. And I went to study there to learn Gaelic, as a lot of school people do before their exams. And I met some people there that were also into metal, and I got introduced to like a perfect circle for the first time, and like that kind of political side of music. And I was just like captivated by it. So obviously, like we have very healthy metal scene here in Ireland, but it is like small. It's quite small. Like the art scene, you kind of see the same people at gigs all the time. Obviously, we've got some great bands. We've got Primordial and Cruacan. And Cruacan are who I sang with for a while. So my partner at the time, he like created the band, and they were going off to do a gig, and they've always had a female singer. So they asked me to sing with them at one gig, and then one gig turned into two, and then it was three, and we were kind of playing all over the place. And it's amazing because like Cruacan play, obviously, it's like Irish folk music, but with a metal twist. So it was really nice because it's like very much kind of the lyrics are part of our history and part of our folklore, and to kind of be able to play that and sing that on stage to people who might share it or have similar stories or similar folklore in their own countries, and you appreciate kind of folk music, and like metal fans are like the most amazing fans in the world. Like, they're just so supportive, and there's nothing like being on stage when there's like thousands of people like going mental underneath.
I agree. I mean, talked about the metal crowd before, and just there's something about that intensity, you know. I actually sent a message to somebody who's a friend of mine. I was like, well, you know, I've been doing a lot of walking, and a lot of stuff has been coming, you know, just kind of coming up, like, like physically and mentally. And she was like, well, I know you're into metal. It's just like, just crank it up and just scream for a little while. You probably haven't screamed for a little while. You probably haven't been to a metal show, which of course is the case, you know. There's just that kind of like primal intensity that I imagine you tap into.
I think it's like, it's interesting that you know, in with metal music, you're very much in touch with the dark side of things as well as the good and the happy and the bright. And it there's a whole spectrum in metal. It goes from the deepest, darkest black metal to like glam and hair metal on a Saturday night when you're ready to have a good time. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's fascinating for me, all the genres and all the places that it goes, you know.
Yeah. Before we get into some other questions, I'm going to ask you one of the big questions that I'm really interested in your answer, Rachel. What is art?
Ooh, that is a great question. And we're discussing that a lot at the moment in Ireland because of this whole COVID situation, and our government have given a lot of grants to businesses, but none to arts and culture specifically.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so there's a lot of conversations happening around what is art and what is the value of art and what we contribute as artists to society. But I mean, art is in everything. You know, it's in the design of your house. It's in the cup that you hold. It's in the music that you listen to when you turn on the radio. It's in the way that somebody says something. You know, it helps us process, and it helps us derive meaning and beauty from things in life. So I think that's what it is for me.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. That's well put. Well, so, and now though, in connection to that, what's the role of art in a pandemic? Because I talk to guests, and some folks are, you know, there's pressures as a creator within the pandemic to create more things, or do I do things online, or do I just try to deal with the mental trauma of what's going on in the world right now? And, you know, can I create? So what's the role of, you know, of art in a pandemic at present?
I think the role in the role of art in a pandemic is the same role that art has at any other time in life. Like, it just helps you to process and to get meaning and beauty from your experiences in life. But I think in a pandemic situation, what's been thrown into the focus, it's really highlighted. First of all, like, when there is nothing else to do, what do we turn to? We turn to books, we turn to listening to music, we listen to podcasts, we start making things, we start baking and painting and watching films and watching TV shows. So we're massively consuming art at the moment on a level that we maybe wouldn't have time for normally. And but at the same time, artists are struggling at a level that they've never struggled at before, because we don't have live performances, and our normal ways of connecting with people have changed. We're having to be, although I don't think anyone is better placed than artists to deal with the challenge of that. So, like, I think many, many amazing things are going to come out of this from artists, but I suppose it throws into question what the value of art is, what people are prepared to pay for it, and how they value it in monetary terms.
Yeah, I think the factor you bring up at the end of the marketplace, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because I think there's different ways to approach this question. And one of the cool things, again, you know, like when I came in contact with you and what you do mm-hmm. with your podcast, where you're the host of Six of One, Half a Dozen of the Other, which is a really funny podcast, and I enjoy it. So I don't know, like, how did that come about? And I love the content, because I noticed, like, I'm like, how does Rachel control these other guys? And uh-huh. you know, it's like, you gotta, you know, it's so fun. And the interaction is really entertaining. But, I mean, how did it come about? I mean, because for me, it comes out of the pandemic, because that's when you started. So yeah, why don't you tell us about your podcast?
Yeah, so I'd be delighted to. Yeah, it's been really fun for us. It basically came about, I'm an artist, a drama facilitator, and I'm like part of this amazing community in Dublin of artists and poets. So on the podcast, we have myself, the poet Jeff, Emmett O'Brien, who's an incredible spoken word artist, and Greg Clifford, who is an artist, like a multidisciplinary artist and singer-songwriter. And we're all good friends. We're very different, I suppose. And we would be used to kind of seeing each other all the time at gigs and events, and like every week, nearly normally when before COVID, we would be at one of our gigs, you know, and we'd see each other and always support each other, or, you know, have groups that meet to write or to work on different things, or like perform at the same festivals and that kind of stuff. So all of that suddenly stopped, and we're kind of sitting at home, and we were all calling each other quite a bit, and like, you mentioned earlier, this kind of tremendous pressure as an artist to like use the time to create something incredible. And we heard all these stories about, you know, Shakespeare writing a whole play in the quarantine, and there just felt like there was this tremendous pressure to kind of produce work. So I think one of the things I really like about our friendship is how different we are, and how much we debate with each other. So we'd often, like, obviously as artists, I think you're kind of thrown into like the political arena a lot, and we're very opinionated, and like your art reflects that, like it reflects your position in society and your beliefs. And ours can be very different sometimes. And we argue and we debate and we disagree, which is important, and we learn from each other, and then it can get very heated sometimes, but at the end of the day we can go, okay, that was a great discussion, like, would you like a beer? You know, so I just thought, like, having these philosophical questions or thought experiments and putting them to this group of friends, who have such different positions and different views and different backgrounds and stuff, to debate them on a podcast. I didn't know if it would work, but I kind of felt like it would, and I have so far. It's been very funny, and it's been really fun, and it's actually been very challenging as well. Like, some stuff has come up for us that we've been like, oh gosh, I didn't expect that to come out. Like, what will people think, you know, that I've said that? Or yeah, it's been very interesting, really, really good fun, and like people have been really enjoying it. So we're into our fourth episode, just got released this week, and we're recording them week by week. Yeah, so hopefully it will continue. I think it will.
Well, and you're all a bunch of smart asses, which makes it a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, we're Irish artists, so. Yeah.
I know when we're thinking about this program, and I'm like king smart ass, and like sometimes, you know, get into that, I was like, man, I'm not going to try to duplicate what they're doing because they got that brew already put together.
It's so snappy. Like, you have to be on it because like everyone is so sharp. Everyone's so sharp. And the guys are great fun. And they're so funny as well. Like, everyone just comes out with stuff that is completely, or like, we start with a question and then we end up talking about something completely different by the end of it. We go off on these tangents, but I think that's part of it.
Yeah. And I spent time in Boston, you know, and there's still the good old Irish American, you know, streak out there in Boston. It's just a great kind of familiarity and just kind of joking about a lot of things. And I always really I enjoy that atmosphere. Rachel, you know, part of what I try to do on the program is to kind of have, if possible, the kind of performative piece that the guest has done. And you've done a spoken word poem that I'm going to play in just a few moments, but and it's about Ireland and a program with the direct provision. Could you give a little bit of background about that policy or that program, and also how your spoken word piece came about, and then we'll play it.
Yeah, so direct provision is a system that we have in Ireland for people who arrive in Ireland seeking asylum. So basically the intention of direct provision is to provide for people while their applications for refugee status and for citizenship in Ireland are being processed. Unfortunately, the system is really barbaric and quite horrific if you start talking to people who've had to live within the system. So how I personally got to know about it is because the theatre company, Croke House Theatre Company and Kildare Youth Theatre that I worked with in Kildare, our premises was very close to a direct provision centre in Kildare in Ireland. And so we were in contact with people who lived in the direct provision system. So it often means that there are families or groups of eight people, or sometimes more, sometimes less, sharing a room the size of a hotel room. And that's a hotel room in Ireland, not the size of a motel room in the US, so smaller again, with no privacy, with no facilities. They're not allowed to cook for themselves. The amount of money they have to live on each week is quite low. It has improved slightly, but it could improve more. Children are allowed to go to school, but after high school, if you want to study, it can be quite difficult in terms of like paying fees and traveling. A lot of these centres are in very remote places in Ireland. It's very hard for people who are living there to integrate, obviously, because they don't have the money to just go out and get coffee or make friends or do any of those things. It's a really horrible system, and I think it's really shameful. It's so embarrassing and shameful for me as an Irish person to know that this is going on in my country and that children are growing up in this kind of regime, in this system that really like dehumanizes them and doesn't serve to let people reach their potential. And I just don't understand why we can't process people's applications faster and give them more dignity. And there is kind of there are a lot of Irish people who are not aware of the direct provision system, and there's a lot of myths that people believe that, you know, that asylum seekers coming into the country get free houses and they get free cars and they get free buggies for their babies and they get free this, that and the other, and they don't understand that the reality is very, very different, and that these people are often very depressed because they can't work, they can't cook, they have no control over their own lives. And that for me is shameful. So yeah, so I think there's a movement at the moment in Ireland to end the direct provision system, which I would very much support. Yeah. So the poem is about that. And the reason that I wrote it is to explain to people maybe who don't know in Ireland what life is like for someone living in that system.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel. Thanks for that background too. I just want to make sure all listeners, you know, get a sense of it. And like you said, a lot of folks over there by you in Ireland aren't particularly familiar with it, which obviously allows you know, mistruths to fester, and we know that process, right?
I'm sure they do. And I think as well, like another point is, like, I think as well in Ireland, and I'm sure in other countries as well, we're very good at saying, like, oh, look at the US and the way people are treated in the US and the way they treat immigrants and in other countries, and we're doing great, but they don't look at what is actually happening here and that it is as bad, if not worse. Do you know what I mean? That we have to start with ourselves.
Absolutely. Okay, thanks, Rachel. I'm going to play the indirect prison, the spoken word poem, and then after that, we'll come back and chat some more.
Great.
Refusing Russian rebels was never an option. Accepting meant conscription, certain death, refusal, execution. So there weren't any options left. Their departure was arranged in hushed tones. Contacts called, belongings sold, papers made, money exchanged. This couple and their baby, 2 years old, who's about to be estranged from her wider family. To cross the border to a land with more opportunity. The baby's passed round to everyone. Her grandma says, just one more kiss. She can't believe that it's come to this. They board the bus and there's no going back. Everything they own is in their arms and this rucksack. At the border, the couple is silent. They hold their breaths as they both hear sirens grinding to a halt. A guard arrives examining the papers of all the people traveling. They hand theirs over, trembling. What if he noticed how my hand shook? He's giving theirs a second look. They think it's over and the game is up. Their pounding hearts make minutes seem like years. The guard takes their papers and disappears. They wait, and it's no fun. Unable to move, unable to run. They shift uneasily in 36 degrees with no breeze, and after an hour or two, they need to pee, but the only toilet on the border is flooded over with cigarettes and contraband left in desperate acts of desperation by people like them. A few hours more, and they're full of dread. Why is the guard not back yet? This is a reminder that these are the lucky ones who have the money to run on this trip that they're taking. Not like the working classes hiding in freight trains fraught with danger or lying in the boot of a car or 10 families deep in a shipping container with children medicated and screaming or locked for days in industrial freezers. Or boats jam-packed with women and children that hit waves and capsize, killing dozens too sick to swim and tired, leaving their loved ones traumatized as they reach for bodies, falling further and further out of reach into the darkness beneath, into oblivion. Yeah, they're glad that that's not them. All these families fleeing right-wing ideologies, subjected to regimes of fear and persecution, countries where they are considered less than human, tortured, broken, forced, and at the wrong end of a mine or a shotgun. So when the guard again makes an appearance, their hearts soar with cautious relief and reassurance. He hands them back their passport in a hurry and he wishes them a pleasant journey. On our soil, Irish soil, they land safely with her, exhausted, dehydrated and starving. You'd think we'd remember the legacy of our famine. They open their mouths and together plead asylum. But for them, this is not the end. This is just the beginning, because now they must endure the purgatory that is direct provision. You see, to me, direct provision sounds like something you might like to see. A direct train to those in need, full of comfort and provisions, trying to heal what hurt can be healed after what just happened. Direct provision centres are the Magdalene laundries of our generation, where we keep those we'd rather not deal with in endless incarceration. No man, woman, or child can develop or thrive inside the four walls of a hotel room, day in, day out, with nothing to do. Remember their two-year-old baby? Imagine she's six now, and she has a brother, and they live in the same hotel room since then with their father and mother, and they go to school, but not the parties they're invited to. Mom and Dad are sick of saying no. They're resourceful, but there's only so far 3880 will go. Their room door can't be locked for health and safety. In 6 years, she doesn't understand the word privacy. Mom and Dad can't own a fridge and they can't work. And the bathroom's shared, so even when you shower, there's a knock. No sleepovers, no visitors, no Wi-Fi and no pets, and this is just the tip of the iceberg of it. Their application isn't processed yet and no one can tell them how long it takes. Some people have been here for 5 years, six, seven, eight. It goes on, and the worst part, her mother tells me, is the boredom. I just want a reason to get up in the morning. I've tried everything. I'm useful. I've tried teaching Russian for free and volunteering. I want to study. I just want to integrate. And I don't know what to say. I can see her hope and her mind is eroding away. And I can't imagine raising a family like this, with no space, holidays, no rest, Netflix, no days out with the kids, no money even for Christmas gifts. And it breaks my heart that there are children in my country who don't know any better than this. This family story has a good ending. 7 years later, and their mother is graduating, their father is working, and they have a house of their own. They have a home. There are others still waiting. I walk past that building and I think of my friend Rico, who waited and waited until all of his teenage years were eradicated. They were taken from him. Forced to share a room with five strange men that he hated, that forced him to pray 3 times a day. But he wasn't religious. All he wanted to do was come and hang out with us. Until he got tired of waiting and ran away. And I still don't know where he is to this day. The last I heard, he paid for fake papers and went to London, and I can't say I goddamn blame him. Or Happy, who's the same age as me and in the same hotel room, she grew up, fell in love, and had a son. Or the old man who got sick because his medication belonged in a fridge and he didn't have one. So next time you see Trump's cages on the front pages and children sobbing and you, like me, feel sick, remember, we are not doing much better than this. And ask the TDs and ministers why it takes so long to process applications in a country that is this goddamn small, and why are private companies running private lives and making it profitable? It's time we put an end to children growing up in prison. And it's time we called it that, instead of direct provision.
Thank you for that, Rachel.
You're welcome. Yeah, I wish it didn't have to be written, but there you go.
Right. One of the things that stuck out to me, even particularly at the end there, is that kind of pernicious, private companies coming in. You know, we have a system within the United States, within some aspects of privatization within the prison system. In the U.S., it's the highest per capita incarceration rate in the history of the world. And, there's a lot of private, hands in that, which, really makes the situation a lot worse, because you know, as you and I know, they can really achieve their profits by what they don't do, even though they're contracted to provide those services. So it seems to me that must create a really pernicious effect as you see it.
Yeah, like I said, there's a lot of people who are not aware of this, of that situation here, and they're not aware that of the companies and the other franchises or the other enterprises that they run, and how we are maybe supporting them inadvertently by using their services elsewhere. And I just think, you know, whenever you have that thing of a profit, or you have an imbalance of power, you are going to have oppression, and that's very much what we can see in that system.
Rachel, if I could take a moment to just mention, I mean, we've got a question regarding, you know, the role of art in addressing, you know, or addressing, disrupting, dismantling racism. And if I could just take a moment, you know, here now in the United States, we're amidst, you know, basically the largest, uprising for civil rights in, some say, in, you know, more than half a century, and it's continuing and growing. It takes many forms of resistance, but it's also becoming, extremely politically divisive and violent. You know, I live in the state of Oregon, where it's very just very, you know, loose around, ability to, you know, carry, you know, arms and rifles. And so it's, you know, almost at points armed conflict with, you know, kind of this right wing, Trump type of thinking, fascism. And so it's a really tense time. And I find that there's so much that is changing. There's been some, results in challenging the role of police, who have basically, you know, been able to murder or injure African-American people in this country for quite some time. In art now, and in what is created, seems to have, you know, the question behind it, you know, what are you doing to address, you know, the history of racism, in a country, or, you know, whiteness versus, you know, the other, these type of constructs. You live in Ireland, and you're an artist. I mean, what do you feel, what's going on there, and what do you feel the role of art is in, you know, addressing these historical injustices?
Well, I can only speak about myself. So I think firstly, our role is to listen, our role is to make space for other people to tell their stories and to share their experiences, and for that space to happen. And that's the major priority at the moment here. Art always has a role in politics, and artists, and art is political. Like, I'm very much with Augusto Boal on this when he says that you know, actors, they act, we act in society, and that theatre and art is a rehearsal for action, and a way of exploring the society we would like to see. And through art, we can have conversations, generate discussions, give voice to the voiceless. And I think this is why theatre and spoken word are so close to my heart, is because anybody can get up anywhere to do theatre and to perform poetry and to speak and to share that with the public. We don't need stages. And that's very much the conversation at the moment with COVID, is that we don't need the physical space. It's lovely to have that, and it's lovely to have the theatres, but the thing about theatre is that anyone can make it. It's for everybody. It's democratized, and that anyone can get up and speak and have the space to share their story and their experience, and that our role as artists is to facilitate that and to provide that, and And then the other, like in a wider perspective, as artists, we can question. Engaging in art gives us lots of skills, like empathy, like listening, like being aware, like critically thinking about looking at different structures, about examining history and power and all of those things.
So Rachel, one of the big questions I ask is why do you create? And, that's the question, but really, in the context, I know we talked about COVID, we talked about, the role of art in addressing racism. And I know that's kind of shaken up the question of why do I create? How much should I be creating? What's the role of art? But you ever ask that fundamental question of, why do you create? And do you feel compelled to create as an artist?
I create because I can't not create. I honestly don't know how to stop. It's the way I make sense of things. It's what brings me joy. It gives me purpose. I just have to be working on something, whatever it is. And maybe part of that is connecting with other people or making sense for myself, what's going on in my own life and my own head. But for me, I create because I have to.
Yeah. Going to go right to the big question now, right after that one is, why is there some
big question?
Yeah, I know. But this is the one where people get a little angry at me for asking, why is there something rather than nothing?
Why is there something rather than nothing? Well, there's always something. That actually reminds me of, I was in a teaching this class once, was like theater skills to a group of students. And they were people who had dropped out of the school system and they were trying to get some kind of education and be introduced to the education system again and encouraged to pass exams. And they were very resistant to theatre. I think a lot of it came from a lot of insecurities or feeling that maybe theatre was something elitist that didn't belong to them or that their voices didn't have a place to be heard. But anyway, I went into them one day and nothing was working and they said they didn't want to do anything. I was like, okay, like, let's do nothing. And I was like, no, you're not doing nothing. You're moving and you're talking and suddenly I was like, there's lots of stuff happening, but it's definitely not nothing. So I don't think you can have nothing.
Yeah, and I appreciate that too. And even the question itself, at least scientists or those more empirically driven point to the question is even more properly stated as how is there something rather than nothing. I always like that big one, and particularly as applied to art in the act of
I probably think that nothing is impossible.
So Rachel, how can I get the listeners here? I want to do a couple things here at the end. Can you let folks know how to connect to all your to your creations? I know you do a lot of different work. Can you lead folks along those lines? And also, at the end, we have a piece of music from one of your co-collaborators on your podcast, Six of One, Half a Dozen the Other, Greg Clifford. If you could just kind of tell us, briefly just about the rest of the gang that's on the podcast, and particularly Greg, and we'll go out with that track.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the best way for people to connect with me is probably through Instagram. So it's Rachel Lally 4. That's RACHELLALLY, all the L's, and just the number 4. And I share a lot of what I'm up to on a daily basis and in terms of my artistic work on Instagram. And you can find other details of social media and stuff there. And the podcast is six of one, half a dozen of the other, and it's on all good podcasting platforms. But I recommend you follow us on YouTube, because we do record video every week, and I have been editing them and stuff and adding little funny graphics and things. So it is kind of worth watching it on YouTube if you can sit down with a cup of tea or a beer and join us there. And on the podcast, it's myself, the poet Jeff, Emmett O'Brien, and Greg Clifford, and you'll find all of their social media details underneath our videos on YouTube as well. And then the track that we're going to play now is one of Greg's tracks, and you can find him on Spotify. And this is a track from a new album that he's working on, which I think is one of the most beautiful pieces of work that he's worked on so far, and certainly one of the most honest pieces. So I personally love it. So that's why I chose it today. So I hope you enjoy.
Yeah, thanks so much, Rachel. Thanks so much for your time. It's really great to chat with you, and really enjoy the program. And I do concur. You do great work on the watching the interaction.
Yeah.
So I definitely recommend that. But yeah, thank you so much for your time. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you, and
to you, really, really nice. I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, thanks, Rachel. Hey, we're going to play that track now, Greg Clifford. I believe the name of the track, is Open Fire, I have it.
That's it, yeah.
Open Fire. Let's play it, and thanks again, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
Open fire upon my heart, limb from limb, torn apart. Oh, now check yourself before you do something you regret. Oh, don't you come on, darling, express yourself. Don't you leave me hanging with these regrets. This ship is sinking, my head's a mess, my head's a mess. Turns foam, acquiesce, chasm growing, we digress. Sweet, sweet serenity, constantly eluding me. Won't you come on, darling, express yourself. Don't you leave me hanging with these regrets. This ship is sinking, a mess, my head's a mess. Won't you come on, darling, express yourself. Don't you leave me hanging with these regrets. This ship is sinking, my head's a mess, my head's a mess. Won't you come on, darling, expose yourself. Don't you leave me hanging on when you've been with someone else. Our ship is sinking, my head's a mess, my head's a mess. Open fire.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you, Rachel, so kindly. I hope you have a great end of the work week, and stay safe, and stay safe the best you can in Dublin.
Thank you so much, Will. I'm off for a swim now in the freezing cold sea.
That sounds strangely fantastic. I'm sure it'll be great. Thanks again, Rachel. You take care.
Thanks, I'm Wish Ken.
Bye now.
Bye.
This is Ken Vellante. Wanted to tell you about a great podcast, Panoptic Podcast. And a couple guys do this, and it's a really great philosophy podcast done by Juan Pablo Melo and Jason Margaritis. And it's a conversations between critical theorist and a management consultant, and really great listen, and kind of giving you really a great conceptual sense of what's going on. They describe it as such: we made this podcast to continue exploring the intersections of our respective disciplines in a way that others might find useful. Panoptic relates theories of communication, power, and technology to practical institutional issues and everyday life. And really worth a listen. Again, Panoptic Podcast. Take your time. It's on all the major venues for podcasts. Panoptic Podcast. Also, wanted to give a shout out and a mention to my brother, Chris Vellante, who works in the financial industry, but also is a coach for running. As a matter of fact, he's going to be the new coach for Groton Dunstable high school boys team out there in Massachusetts. And he does a coaching program that helps runners, you know, train for road races, various distances, create a plan to address or return from injury. And also to just kind of help train with, you know, nutrition and, you know, basically set out a plan to accomplish your running goals. So that's Vellante Running. And you can find him most easily on Facebook under Vellante Running. V as in Victor, O-L-A-N-T-E. And that's my brother, Chris Vellante. Thanks so much. And I hope you enjoy this program.